From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello and welcome to episode 56 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, producer, and good friend Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing well. Just keeping busy.
Yeah.
With all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah. So, it's a very stressful point in both of our lives right now for two very different reasons. But yes. At least, you know, on the opposite side of things, I enjoy that we have an outlet like this where at least you and I get to come together and talk and take our minds off the world for just a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. So it's always good for everybody to have passions and hobbies and things like that. There was interesting one of our local radio shows. They were talking about how people don't have hobbies anymore. And this show, well, you know, it's a job, but you know, the research is sort of a hobby and the reading. But they were talking about how people don't have hobbies because, like, if people are into macrame or they're into, you know, making jewelry, people immediately ask, well, do you sell that on Etsy? Do you sell that on eBay? And, I mean, there's an expectation, you know, you're going to monetize your passion. And how people just don't do things because they enjoy it, you know, anymore. And and I agree. I think it's important. Everybody does something just for the pure pleasure of it.
Yeah,
it's very therapeutic and relaxing. So,
I agree. And it's I was actually just thinking about that tonight because I was doing a I was working on a Blu-ray review, and it's just one of those things where I really enjoy I enjoy watching them and I enjoy doing it for work, but it's like, well, now I'm blending my outside hobby with work. But you know what? There could be worse things to do.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I did too. I used to just studying about Walt and, you know, learning about Disney history was a hobby, and then happily, you know, it got turned into a job, which was nice. So, but I still have gardening, you know, as my hobby. So,
yeah, and I saw the pictures. I think you just posted it this past weekend of your garden. It might have been the one before, but it just looked beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yes, spring is my favorite time of year.
Yeah,
so
I can understand why
everything's blooming. Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of things like that, is that, you know, one of the themes that Craig and I emphasize, you know, on Connecting with Walt is how important it is to look for ways to incorporate Walt's positive outlook and, you know, work ethic in our daily lives as a way to continue his legacy. And it just felt to us like the time was right to share my conversation with Jeffrey Barnes from the December 1st, 2015 episode of the Diz Unplugged podcast, Disneyland Edition. Jeffrey is the author of the book, The Wisdom of Walt, and he uses the inspirational story of the life of Walt Disney, Disneyland, and Walt Disney World to challenge us to think bigger, expand our expectations, and gives advice to how to overcome our limited thinking to make our dreams a reality. So we believe our Connecting with Walt family will find my conversation with Jeffrey entertaining and meaningful. So sit back, relax, and enjoy listening to Jeff Barnes talk about the wisdom of Walt. For Disney fans, December is the month we remember the birth of Walt Disney on December 5th, 1901, and regret his passing on December 15th, 1966. It seems fitting that those of us who appreciate Walt Disney look back on his life and legacy.
Joining us with a look back at Walt's legacy is author, university professor, and leadership and success coach, Jeff Barnes, the author of The Wisdom of Walt, Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth. Jeff, welcome to the Diz Unplugged Disneyland podcast.
Hello, Michael, and I am thrilled to be with you tonight.
Thank you. Now, we're thrilled to have you because we met at D23 Expo very briefly, but then I got to hear you speak at MouseCon a couple of weeks ago and thoroughly enjoyed your presentation.
Well, thank you. Both events were fabulous. I had a great time at D23, and I actually spent 14 years in the Bay Area, so any chance I have to go back to San Francisco or anywhere close to San Francisco, I'm always happy to do that as well. So both D23 and MouseCon were a thrill for me.
Great. Now, one of the things that piqued my interest when we got to talking and I read about you, read your book, is that you are teaching a university course on the history of Disneyland for credit. So how did this come about? And of course, all us Disney fans are thinking, oh, this would be an easy A. So can you tell us about the course, how it came to be?
Sure. I'm Dean of Academic Services at California Baptist University in Riverside, California, which is in the Inland Empire, about 33 miles from Main Street, USA. And I, as part of my faculty or teaching responsibilities, I also teach U.S. history. And when I was teaching the second half of U.S. history, being a Disney nut and a Disney fan, I naturally think that you cannot lecture on the 1950s without saying something about the opening of Disneyland, because it certainly had a huge impact on us as Americans, on us as Californians, and a significant impact on, you know, the entertainment and, you know, amusement park industry. And I noticed that my, you know, naturally engaged students, you know, peaked up even more when I would give those sort of very basic lectures on the opening of Disneyland in 1955. And then, you know, one afternoon I asked a very critical question. It was a class with well over 60 students. And I just did a quick poll. How many of you have been to Disneyland? And of course, being only 33 miles away, every single hand shot up. But then, Michael, the most important question was the follow-up question. I then asked them, well, how many of you, because you grew up in Southern California, were so young the very first time you went to Disneyland, you don't even remember your very first visit? And well over 75% of those same 60 hands went up again. And that's when I realized, because, you know, the park is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. That's when I came to recognize there's an entire generation that has grown up with A, Disneyland in their backyard. They've never known a world without it. But then B, they've also grown up without Walt Disney himself. And so I just came to realize that because I believe the park is such a phenomenal source of inspiration and motivation, that these students needed to hear the stories of Walt Disney and the stories of Disneyland itself. And that's sort of where that idea and that dream was born.
I think that's interesting, because one of the questions I have, because being the Disney historian for the Diz, is that I'm able to meet a lot of the people who are still alive who work directly with Walt. And I've always wondered, what is the fandom going to be like in about 10 years or so, when nobody who worked directly with Walt is with us any longer?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. You know, we kind of went through this a decade or so ago when we, you know, were talking about World War II and the so-called greatest generation, and, you know, starting to recognize that we were losing, you know, that group of people at an alarming rate. And of course, as time, you know, moves on, you know, the same thing, you know, happens in future decades and to future generations. And so, you know, with the history of Disneyland class, the very first lecture that I give is the Walt Disney of Disneyland, recognizing that, you know, today's generation and today's students know very, very, very little about him. And most importantly, from my perspective, they have no idea that he wasn't born successful. They have no idea that he had a difficult childhood. They had no idea that, almost no one believed or bought into the idea of Disneyland, and they certainly have no idea that any of his movies ever failed or that Walt ever went bankrupt. And so, again, he provides, at least for me, that ultimate source of inspiration and motivation, you know, to go after our dreams with the highest level of courage and confidence possible.
Now, will this class ever be offered online?
You know, Michael, I get that question almost every day. Uh-huh. And I teach courses both face-to-face in the classroom and online. And that is definitely one of the projects in the queue. Now, I have to be honest, the queue is getting longer with each passing day. But yes, the course will be offered online. I can't tell you when, but we're going to develop it in an online format some way, somehow.
Oh, that would be great. I think we'd have a lot of listeners who would sign up for that. So now, when did you first become a Disney fan?
Well, I grew up in Florida, interestingly enough, and at the age of 10, went to Walt Disney World in 1974. And, you know, the second I stepped onto Main Street, even in, you know, Florida's version of the Magic Kingdom, I just sort of instantly knew that this place was different, that this place was special. And so almost overnight, I became that kid all the way through high school. You know, anytime we were going to, you know, Disney World, whether it was as a family or, you know, high school band trip, Boy Scouts, whatever the case may be, you know, I was always the one most looking forward to it. I was always the one, you know, counting down the days. And then, oddly enough, I didn't get to Disneyland, the original, until I was in grad school in 1988. And to be honest with you, I hated Disneyland the very first day that I went. I thought it was incredibly small. I, you know, thought it was way overcrowded. It happened to be a very hot day in August. And, you know, the very first attraction we decided to ride when we walked into the park at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning was Star Tours, because that was the brand new attraction. And it took us over 3 hours before we had ridden our very first Disneyland attraction. And if you had told me that night I was going to end up falling in love with the place to the point I was going to teach a college course on it and then ultimately write a book, I would have told you that you were absolutely crazy. But then when I was returning with a group of young people a few years later, I came to realize I had to have missed something, because it's obviously a big deal here in California. It obviously was a big enough deal here in the United States that they built an even bigger one in Florida, and of course, by that point, you know, had other parks around the world. And so I started doing the research, and that's when I came to discover that Walt willed Disneyland against all odds and all obstacles out of orange groves in what was then the middle of nowhere, you know, in Anaheim, south of Los Angeles. And it was that story, that story of success and motivation and inspiration and failure and moving forward that really just connected with me. And so before I knew it, when I would go into the park, I would see Walt's footsteps everywhere and examples of, you know, success and examples of how, you know, we should be living our life around every turn and in almost every land. And so it was that story and that connection that really made me fall in love with the place in ways I never could have imagined on that first visit.
Yeah. And, you know, we hear a lot from, we have a Disney World show as well. And we hear from a lot of listeners to that show, oh, they'd never want to go to Disneyland because it's so small and we have Disney World and it's so big. And we say, just come on out. And there's an intangible difference that you're going to feel when you come into this park. And just about all of them, once they come into Disneyland, of all of the castle parks, Disneyland then becomes their favorite park.
Yeah, there is a certain level of charm and quaintness and magic that I don't think can be replicated. Part of that is Walt's you know, footsteps and imprint. Part of it is the manner in which he genuinely wanted us to experience what it would be like, you know, to step into a story and live in some sort of storybook. And so everything was built, you know, to that sort of scale, as opposed to trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with the largest and most massive numbers of people, you know, possible. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is, you know, Disneyland hugs you, Walt Disney mm-hmm. World swallows you.
Yes. And I think it was Rolly Crump, I think, said that.
Yeah. I generally prefer to be HUD. And yeah. You know, maybe that's just me.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Walt, in your book, The Wisdom of Walt, Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth, you suggest that there's a more meaningful way we can carry on Walt's legacy in our lives than by just visiting the theme park, seeing Disney films, you know, and filling our homes with Disney collectibles. So in your book, you write that Walt Disney and Disneyland are the perfect vehicles for challenging ourselves and motivating us to reach our goals. So where do we begin in that process?
Well, for me, it begins with that park bench on Main Street. And what I challenge the reader to do is to imagine what it was like to be Walt Disney in the 1940s. And yes, he's already successful and he's already created Mickey Mouse. And, you know, he's a household name by way of his movies in Hollywood. And, you know, then on a random Saturday with his young daughters, Diane and Sharon, he's sitting on this park bench at Griffith Park, and they're riding the merry-go-round, and he's sitting there eating a bag of peanuts, and all of a sudden he has this idea. You know, there should be a place where parents and children can have fun together. And it was in that moment that the idea and then ultimately the dream of Disneyland was born. And from that single thought, I believe he changed our world by creating entirely new and different worlds. And of course, when you go into Disneyland today, you can see that park bench in the Opera House there on Main Street, which ironically enough was the very first building built at Disneyland, because before it was the Opera House, it was first the lumber mill. And so that's where they milled the lumber for constructing the remainder of the park in 1955. But it's also in the Opera House where we find not only the park bench, but also the great moments with Mr. Lincoln attraction. And it was Lincoln himself who once said, "You live the life you think about." And Walt Disney had an idea. And I think all of us have ideas. All of us have these nagging thoughts. All of us have these crazy dreams. Walt had the courage to pursue his. And I think our world would be a lot better off if many more of us had that same level of encouragement to pursue those crazy ideas, those nagging thoughts, and those dreams that no one else wants to believe in.
Yeah, I agree. Now, there was a line in your book that I liked, where you write that the first step to success is to do exactly what Walt did, nothing. And I imagine everybody's thinking, nothing, I do that every day. So I should be climbing high on that ladder to success. So there has to be a little more to this.
Well, there is. And when I say doing nothing, what I'm really talking about is giving yourself the chance to have your ideas take root, really give yourself a chance to stop and dream for a little bit, you know, whether it's, you know, for an hour on the weekend or, you know, when you know, trying to relax on vacation and just trusting that, you know, your brain is going to give you the ideas that you need to push forward and to make your life better. And then, you know, hopefully the world better as well. And so, yeah, you know, Walt's sitting on that park bench and he has this, you know, crazy idea, you know, there should be a place where parents and children have fun, you know, together. But of course, at some point he had to take action. And as he began to take action, you know, what began as a single thought, what, you know, ultimately became a dream, you know, would morph eventually into something that was way bigger than even he could ever imagine. But first he had to trust his ideas and he had to trust his thinking. And I think, you know, too many of us, we get so busy and so wrapped up in doing that we don't ever stop and just think and allow ourselves to dream.
That's very true. I think that's especially true with young people today because they have so much coming at them with technology that they're constantly plugged into something. And I know I'm always telling my class, they have to give themselves quiet time every day.
Yes.
And, or, you know, they're not going to have time to just be alone with their thoughts.
Yeah. I actually say this in the book itself. There's a chapter entitled Building a Berm where I use the berm that Walt created at Disneyland for keeping the magic inside the Magic Kingdom and all of the distractions of the outside world outside of the park. I actually, challenged the reader, to focus on their ideas and to focus on their dreams. And that's going to require some discipline, specifically discipline away from distractions. And I'll be honest with you, if Walt Disney were sitting on that park bench at Griffith Park in 2015, I don't think he'd be sitting there alone. And I don't think he'd be sitting there alone with his ideas and his dreams and a bag of peanuts. He'd probably be playing Candy Crush on his cell phone.
And that's hard to mention.
well, exactly. And, our world would be significantly less, I believe, as a result. Now, having said that, I love technology. Don't get me wrong. But, technology has its place. We need to give our ideas and our thinking and our dreams a place as well.
Now, once we have our dream or idea, what can we learn from Walt's life and legacy that will enable us to make our dream a reality?
Well, I think, you have to realize the importance and the significance of taking action. And there's a couple of key points there. First of all, if your dream were easy, somebody else would have already done it by now. So the second you have this crazy thought, your inner critic is immediately going to try and take over and tell you why that's just the dumbest thing ever. And if your inner critic doesn't take over, well, then the minute you share it with anyone around you, they're going to try and take over as well. And I go back to Walt. The last thing his wife Lily wanted was for them to get into the amusement park business. I mean, she said to him, Walt, why in the world do you want to build an amusement park? Those places are filthy and dirty. And then, he gets to the studio and his lifelong partner and financial backer, Roy, Roy wanted nothing to do with Disneyland and nothing to do with getting into the amusement park, business either. So, the first thing you're going to have to do is battle your inner critic, and then you're going to have to believe in your idea and believe in your dream strong enough to face those who tell you that it's impossible. And you have to have a level of confidence. Walt once said, the secrets to success come down to four C's. And for Walt, those four C's were curiosity, confidence, courage, and consistency. And then he would go on to say that out of the four C's, it was confidence that was most important. And so when Walt came up with this idea of a place where parents and children could have fun together, and as it grew and morphed into something really special and really different and really magical, and everyone, including his wife and his brother, was coming along and saying, Walt, you're crazy and this is never going to work and you're going to drive us bankrupt, he had enough courage to stand up to his idea and stand behind his dream and keep moving forward.
Yeah, I like how, when you're talking about the inner voice, that you compared it, it's sort of like Disney attractions and films. And just like in Walt's own life, there's a hero and a villain in our inner voice. And you said that in our inner voice resides our true genius, but also is our evil inner critic. And we have to defeat that inner critic, just like the villains are defeated in Disney films.
Absolutely. And, as I've done multiple presentations on the book, what I see connecting with the audience again is the idea, we as human beings, we love stories. Stories are why we read books. It's why we go to the movies. It's the way in which Disneyland uses story that sets it apart from any other amusement or any other theme park. We love stories, but in order to have a good story, in order to have a great story, you have to have conflict. And as much as any of us want to live a great story, too often we sort of want to run in the opposite direction when it comes to conflict. And so what I challenge the reader to do is to look at their life and to look at their dream as if it were some great story. And if you have conflict, that's a good sign, because the bigger the dragon, the bigger the conflict, the better the story. You again, just have to have confidence and keep moving forward. Otherwise, your life is boring and no one's ever going to care about your dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting because Walt wanted to be remembered as a great storyteller.
First and foremost.
Yeah. And I think we all agree that he was. And he shared his story through the films and attractions. And he invited us to share the experience. And so as you said in your book, Walt and Disneyland don't just remind us of the importance of great storytelling. They challenge us to live a great story.
So. Yeah. And again, Walt wanted you to step into the story. And part of the whole purpose of Main Street, you know, it wasn't, you know, all of the amusement park operators in the 1950s said he was absolutely nuts, A, for having one entrance in and one entrance out. They said it would never work. And then two, you know, this idea that he was going to spend all of this money on landscaping and theming in an area that had virtually no attractions and thus almost no way to generate real revenue. I mean, they just thought it would, you know, he's off his rocker. But, you know, Walt wanted to set up the opening shot to your story or your day at Disneyland. And then once you get to the central hub, you then get to pick your own story based on which direction or which land you go into. And again, you have to remember, this is 1955. And what's new out in that world is the idea of television. And so there's like three or four channels at best. And so you sort of have to look at the central hub as like the channel dial on a television set. And you can pick, you know, Adventureland, you can pick Frontierland, you can pick Fantasyland, you can pick Tomorrowland. But Walt's going to set up that opening and closing scene, that opening and closing shot by way of your walk down Main Street as you come into the park and then as you exit on your way out.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting what you said about people like stories. And you said that in your presentation, your book, and just now. And because this, I've taught eighth grade for many, many years. And this year I'm teaching sixth grade. And so it's a huge change. Those 2 years make an incredible difference.
Sure.
But so I'm dealing with, I had forgotten how squirrely 11-year-old boys can be. And so I'm talking to them and yeah, I'm trying to get through to them in class. And some of them, and I'm thinking, dear Lord, give me the eighth graders. And one of the young guys says, tell us a story. We like stories. And I thought, I have to completely change my whole method of how I'm communicating with them. Yep. And the minute I changed everything into storytelling, and how I presented everything was through the unfolding of a story, no matter what the class topic. Now they're tuned in.
Yeah. Well, and there's actual neuroscience that says when someone says to us, let me tell you a story, our brain reacts and responds to that. We go into a completely different mode. And, you know, we live in the world of so-called big data. Story is data with a soul. And that's what we connect with. It's what we remember. And, you know, again, you know, Disneyland tells great stories, but in telling those great stories, I think it's ultimately challenging all of us to then in turn live a great story.
Now, have you been to the Walt Disney Family Museum?
I have. We were there last December, actually, as I was doing research for the book.
Because one of the statements we hear Walt saying at the Walt Disney Family Museum is that everyone needs to have a good, hard failure in their life. You know, the bankruptcy of Walt's Kansas City animation studio motivated him to move to California and open a Disney Brothers studio. So Walt never allowed failure to defeat him. And you have several examples in your book showing how Walt turned his failures into successes with the message that we shouldn't be frightened or discouraged by failure.
No, we really shouldn't be. And I think part of the challenge is, you know, we sort of live in a world where, you know, we try to protect ourselves from everything and it's impossible. And so the only thing we can successfully protect ourselves from is success itself, when we are too afraid to fail. And I don't want to glorify failure. It stinks. It's awful. It's painful. But it's also where we learn some of life's most important lessons. If Walt had never gone bankrupt, he may not have ever come out to California. If Walt had never lost Oswald the Rabbit, he probably never comes up with Mickey Mouse. You know, he had a series of failures and setbacks throughout his entire life. More of his movies failed to make money than actually turned a profit. And it wasn't really until, you know, the early to mid 1960s that he really reached that level of success where people actually had confidence that Walt himself knew what it was that he was doing. And then, of course, you know, unfortunately, he passed just a few years after that. So, you know, again, you're going to fail. If you're not failing, you're simply not trying hard enough. It is part of life. It's part of the experience. It's part of the journey. And quite frankly, it's part of the recipe for success. So, you know, you simply have to pick yourself up. You have to keep moving forward. And, you know, Lily's wife once said Walt was never beaten at anything. Yes, he failed, but he was never beaten at anything.
Mm-hmm. Another important tenet in your book that you took from Walt's life, and I think this relates to that, is that we also have to take responsibility for our mistakes and learn from our mistakes. And I think this is very apropos for some of the things we're hearing in the news lately. And remember that life is not always fair. And because I think younger people right now seem to struggle with all these concepts of taking responsibility for mistakes, learning from them, but just knowing, hey, you know what? Sometimes life just isn't fair and we have to move on with that.
Yeah, I think one of the earliest lessons we need to learn is that life isn't fair. And the sooner we learn that, the sooner we can get on really with the rest of our lives. Because if we sit around waiting for life to be fair, we're going to be sitting around for a really, really, really long time. And again, you're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. And, you know, the key is learning from them. You know, the key is taking responsibility for what you need to take responsibility for and then move on. And even when it comes to Disneyland, you know, Walt was 53 when the park opened, and it certainly was his biggest dream ever. And everybody, you know, believed that it was going to fail. And if you go back and you look at the first day, even though we, you know, celebrate it as this, you know, special birthday 60 years later, if you go back and you look at the first day, it was exactly what everyone feared it would be, a failure. It was much more Tragic Kingdom than it was Magic Kingdom. And yet by September, they had had 1 millionth guest. And, you know, attendance was 50% higher than predicted. So, you know, how did they go from what came to be known of as Black Sunday on July 17th to, you know, really having it all turned around in just a couple of months? And I believe it rests with Walt and his personality and the manner in which he took responsibility for all of the mistakes and all of the ills that were present on opening day. And, you know, what he couldn't take responsibility for, he just let go of and moved on. So, for example, I mean, is it fair to open up your dream in July in Southern California at 2:30 in the afternoon in a 105-degree heat wave that would last for 2 weeks? Probably not. But what can you do about it? There wasn't anything he could do about it except keep moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he didn't know there's going to be a plumber's strike and asphalt strike. I mean, all kinds of things.
Yeah, gas leak in Fantasyland, and
yeah.
you know, people counterfeiting, you know, the opening day tickets. You know, massive backups on, you know, the freeway. I mean, the list of failures on opening day is quite lengthy. But mm-hmm. they learned their lesson. And that's why they do soft openings even to this day. And if you go back and you look at how they opened up, you know, Walt Disney World, you know, they say, you know, that, you know, Disney World opened on October 1st of 1971. It was really 3 weeks of soft openings before they fully opened that park. And it was all because they didn't want to repeat the disaster that was Black Sunday in 1955.
Right. Yeah. Now there's a very creative chapter of your book in which you explain how we can learn from Walt and the Imagineers' use of forced perspective in building Main Street USA and Sleeping Beauty Castle to enable ourselves to live the inverted life. So can you tell our listeners what is the inverted life?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, forced perspective is this idea that you can use architecture to play tricks on people and have them think they're seeing one thing when really they're standing next to something, you know, completely different. So, for example, again, Walt wanted the park to be this storybook, and the train is built on a 5/8 scale. If Walt had had his way, the entire park would have been built on a 5/8 scale. And, you know, the architects literally had to sit him down and say, well, that's not going to work because, you know, these are real sized people and they have to shop and they have to eat and they have to experience these attractions in very real ways. And so the solution was to use forced perspective. So, for example, on Main Street, you know, the ground floor, which is, you know, where we will traverse when we go into the park, those are all built anywhere from 90 to 100% scale. But then the second story is built to 3/4 scale. And then if there's a third floor, those are typically built to half scale. And all of that makes the park look a little larger than it actually is, which gives it that storybook feel that makes it feel so quaint and so charming. Well, what I try to teach our students when it comes to success and life and leadership is life is not what happens to you. We think that it is, but it isn't. Life is not what happens to you. It's how we respond to what happens to you. And Walt once said, happiness is a state of mind. It is just according to the way you look at things. In other words, life is all about perspective. And the Imagineers force our perspective when we walk into Disneyland. And I challenge the readers to force their perspective as they live their life and to recognize it's not what happens to you. It's how we respond to what happens to you. And so then in the souvenir stop for that chapter, what I challenge the reader to do is to use the ground floor of their life for gratitude. In other words, recognize what you already have and the reasons that exist already for why you should be thankful and why you should be grateful. And then the second story are your dreams and your ideas, your goals and your aspirations, the successes that you're still striving for. And then the third floor is really the smallest floor, and that's where you honestly assess all of the obstacles and barriers and difficulties between where you are and the dream that you're still striving for. And the reason why I say that is the inverted life is if we're honest with ourselves, typically we build the ground floor. We spend the majority of our time complaining, whining, and moaning about all of the barriers and all of the obstacles and all of the challenges. And so, again, what I'm trying to do is get the reader to sort of turn that upside down, if you will, and that will enable us, rather than, you know, reacting but responding, so that we can keep moving forward and make our dreams a reality.
Yeah. And you're right. It's human nature to focus more on the negative. And the inverted life is focusing more on the positive.
Yes.
And moving forward with them. I really like that. Another thing that you mentioned was about, that Walt was a visionary. I mean, you in anything you read about him, that's what they say. He was a visionary. And you in your book wrote that being able to visualize our dreams as Walt did is critical to achieving them. And it reminded me of a wonderful story. Walt was sitting on a bench in Disneyland in 1957, looking up at what was known as Holiday Hill with a smile on his face. And I think it was Imagineer Harriet Burns walked up to him and asked, Walt, what are you looking at? And he said, I'm looking at my mountain. And he said that with a grin. And Harriet said, well, there's no mountain there. But 2 years later, Walt dedicated his mountain, the Matterhorn bobsleds, on that spot where Holiday Hill had stood. So we, as you say, too, we have to be able to visualize as Walt did in order to achieve our dreams. They have to become real for us.
Yeah, and there's a couple of great stories that I think really illustrate that. First of all, Art Linkletter, who, you know, of course, was the opening day broadcaster for the ABC television show on July 17th, 1955, he was interested in what Walt was up to even before Walt hired him to be the master of ceremonies. And so early in 1954, a few months after construction had started, Walt took him down to Anaheim, and I don't believe up to that point Art Linkletter had ever even been to Anaheim. And now he's trekking down there, you know, with Walt to see this place called Disneyland, and they pull into this orange grove, and the only thing that's there are some trees and some piles of dirt and a bulldozer. And the second they get out of the car, Walt is pointing to where the railroad is going to be and where Main Street will be and where the Jungle Cruise will run and where, you know, Dumbo the Flying Elephant will soar over Fantasyland. And the entire time, Art Linkletter is sitting there thinking, my poor delusional friend, you are going to build roller coasters and merry-go-rounds out here in the middle of nowhere. You're going to go bankrupt. And yet, standing on that same patch of dirt, Walt could see every bit of it as if it already existed. And then there's another great story when they were dedicating Walt Disney World, the opening of the Magic Kingdom in October of 1971. A worker commented, you know, it's a real shame that Walt didn't live to see this. And then Mike Vance turned around and replied to that worker, he did see it. That's why it's here. And
yes.
That's the beauty of vision.
Yeah, there's a story when Walt was still alive. He liked to, when they went to Florida, when they were buying the land and all that, he liked to fly low over it. And so in one of the tours when they were flying over it, and he had his inner circle that knew about the project with him, and he's showing them this land and he's pointing out to them where everything's going to be and all this stuff. And they're all sitting there thinking, this is like the worst place on earth. I mean, all they could see was swampland,
yeah,
and everything. And then as they're looking at this totally befuddled, you know, Walt then just says with the smile, yes, this is going to work out perfectly.
Yeah, he really was. He was a unique individual that way because he had that vision to see the future, to see things tomorrow that no one else could possibly see. And yet at the same time, he had that touch of history and that touch of nostalgia, you know, that Midwestern turn of the century America. And so the manner in which he bridged both during the 20th century is part of what makes him so special and so unique, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always say he defined, childhood for generations.
Yep.
Because what would childhood be if we didn't have them? I mean, everything's compared to Disney.
Yep.
You know, whatever it is.
Yep.
So, now, again, working towards a goal, reaching a dream, one of the hardest things for me to do is to ask for help. Because I want to be independent and do it myself. And I'm sure others do. Pardon me?
I said good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, and when you were talking, but you know, as I'm reading your book and how Walt was an idea man, and I even realized that when he was starting out with his animation studio, and he realized right away, there are people that can draw a whole lot better than me. And so he hired them. And then that was true with everything. He had the ideas, but realized in order to get them done, he had to ask for help.
Yeah, Walt was a starter way, way more than he was a finisher. And so, you know, he very much was that vision person and that idea person, but he wasn't afraid to build a team. And while he would go on to say that he most wanted to be remembered as a storyteller, what he was most proud of was the actual Disney organization that he had been, you know, successful in creating. And he would go on to say, you know, you can build the most special magical theme park in the world, but it's going to take a team of people to make it run and to make it work. And so, you know, you have to know going in, whatever your dream is, you cannot do it alone. There aren't a lot of lone rangers out there who can actually make that happen. And Walt didn't build Disneyland or Disney World or even the Disney Studios by himself any more than I wrote The Wisdom of Walt by myself. I mean, yes, I'm the author, but this book would not exist if it weren't for my wife, who was a willing, you know, partner alongside with me. And it really wouldn't exist, you know, without an editor and without a publisher and without a printer and without a foreword by, you know, Garner Holt of Garner Holt Productions. It takes an entire team of people to help make that crazy idea, that crazy dream possible. And so you have to be willing to ask people for help on your dream. And you have to be willing to trust them that they're alongside you and they have a key part of the process to help make it all real.
Excellent. Good. And then what do you do for the procrastinators? That's another one of mine, my roadblocks, well, and probably other people too.
It certainly is my number one challenge. And that's been a lifelong struggle. You know, Walt himself once said the best way to get something done, the best way to get something done is to stop talking about it and start doing. And so my encouragement, you know, to our listeners and then ultimately to the reader is, you know, to realize, quote unquote, Tomorrowland. And I like that play on words there. Tomorrowland is not your friend. What you do today is the best predictor of what you're going to do tomorrow. And so the challenge is pick something toward your idea, something toward your dream that you can work on for 5 minutes today, right now, before the end of the evening. And then recognize that over time you can build on those 5 minutes. 5 minutes can become 10 minutes. 10 minutes can become half an hour. And before you know it, momentum sort of just starts taking over, and you find yourself much further along in the journey, as opposed to just beating yourself up because you're putting it off, putting off, putting it off, and you haven't started and you've gone nowhere.
And I think what might help folks overcome procrastination too is, you mentioned this early on in the book, is you have to find out what excites you, what are you you're passionate about, and pursue that.
Yes, and you know, even I think you have to trust your passion. And I write about how even though Walt was 53 when he opened Disneyland, I think the earliest seeds of it go back to his youngest days and his childhood and the stories of his father. You know, when Elias worked at the, you know, World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. But you not only have to trust the passion, you also have to trust the process. And so you're going to get started on your dream, and it's going to feel crazy, and it's going to feel awkward, and you don't know everything that you need to know to make it happen, but you know you can't really procrastinate on it anymore, so you're just going to start somewhere. And that's okay, because not only are you trusting your passion, but you're trusting the process that as you move forward, the process is going to reveal itself in terms of what you need to be doing and how you need to be doing it. And the example there is, you know, if you go back and you look at the original Herb Ryman map of Disneyland that Walt challenged him to draw in 1953, you see a lot that looks like Disneyland. Disneyland when it opened in 1955, Disneyland even today, the park that, you know, I was visiting just yesterday. And yet at the same time, you also see elements in that drawing that never came to fruition. That map is simply a part of the process. And as they kept moving forward, you know, some of that map would actually get poured into concrete and become, you know, the dream and the actual reality, and other parts would move and shift and morph into something completely different. But none of it would have happened if they hadn't have started doing and moved forward with the process.
Yeah, and another thing that you mentioned is part of the process is patience. And because I'm, you know, mentioning my sixth graders again, that's one thing that I notice they have a little less of than maybe their generation before them. And I think it's because, again, they're just used to getting things faster, information faster, results faster than maybe my generation, where we really had to wait for results. And you point out in your book, visiting Disneyland teaches all of us patience.
Yeah, and you know, people are sort of surprised to find out I'm not really a crowd person, and I absolutely hate to wait in line. And the main reason for that is I'm simply not a patient person. My wife Nikki, you know, has said on more than one occasion she's never seen me lose my patience, because you simply cannot lose what you've never had. And so, you know, when you go to Disneyland, and I don't care how early you get there, and I don't care how good you get at using fast passes, you're eventually at some point going to find yourself waiting in line. Walt waited a long time for his dreams to come true. You know, Walt would stand in line to experience the attractions just like any and every guest would. And there's a real lesson there. You know, success does not happen overnight. You know, we all want instant gratification, and life simply doesn't work that way. And you're right. You know, the generation today, you know, they're used to pushing a button and having whatever it is that they want or whatever it is that they desire. And, you know, we're going to have to slow things down a little bit and be willing to wait in line. In other words, be willing to keep moving forward, be patient, and trust that at the end of the line, you know, whatever is waiting for us is that dream and that success that we're striving for.
And now once we strive for that, and we, let's say we reach our dream, a common thread in my two series I do, 60 Years of Disneyland on this show and Connecting with Walt, is that Walt Disney was always working on a project. So when he finished one, he usually never looked back at it again, and he went on to the next. And you say we have to do the same in our own lives. When we've accomplish something, we have to ask ourselves, what is my impossible next?
Yeah, we don't ever want to become stagnant. I think as people, we're meant to strive, we're meant to change, we're meant to achieve. If you go back to, you know, even with Snow White, you know, they poured everything into the world's first, you know, full-length animated, you know, movie. And like Disneyland, nobody believed that that would work either. And yet after the rave opening premiere at the Carthay Theater, the next day Walt had already moved on. You know, some of the, you know, animators instead of the studio employees really wanted to stop and, you know, sort of revel in their success. And, you know, they were really shocked to come to the studio the next day. And, you know, Walt was already moving on and, you know, plotting, you know, the next course. And he wasn't a big fan of sequels. And I think sort of what's been forgotten in his death in December of 1966 is, you know, the dream of Disney World was not to do Disneyland 2.0 mm-hmm. or to do another Magic Kingdom in Florida. His real dream was to do Epcot. And, you know, Magic Kingdom was just sort of a necessary part of that process in order to get the state of Florida to buy into the, you know, sort of governmental control that he needed to make the entire project happen, but especially, you know, Epcot. So, you know, he once said, as long as there was imagination left in the world, Disneyland would never be finished. And I think that's a good line for all of us to remember. As long as we have imagination, we ourselves, like Disneyland, will never be finished.
Yeah, that's very good. I like that. I think it's a good way for us to live our lives. And it allows us to sort of stay fresh.
You know. Well, I certainly hope so. And I spent this past year, you know, writing The Wisdom of Walt, and then, you know, spent the last, you know, 6 months, you know, launching the book and working really hard to get it into the hands of as many people as possible. And then this past weekend, you know, I sort of had to, you know, read my own final chapter about always needing the next. And, you know, realizing, okay, you wrote a great first book, time to do a second one. And, you know, as much as I don't really want to per se, I know that I need to, because that's how we stay fresh and that's how we stay current.
So what motivated you to write The Wisdom of Walt?
Well, I've had this idea probably since that second trip to Disneyland, when I had, you know, read the stories and the history of the park and all of the obstacles that Walt faced in getting it open. And then, you know, just looking around and, you know, seeing the berm and the way in which, you know, it's filled with attractions that tell stories rather than just amusement park rides, you know, just sort of started connecting the dots in terms of, wow, this place really is a source of inspiration and a source of motivation. It's not just the place where dreams come true, but it's a living, breathing example of how all of us can live our lives in such a way that our own dreams can come true. And that idea has sort of been germinating around in my life and in my head for about 20 years now, long before the History of Disneyland, you know, class. And then as I write about in the book, the day after I gave the very first lecture in that dream course, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And, you know, the good news is, you know, we now know that fortunately the tumor was not, you know, cancerous, you know, but I, you know, put off brain surgery so that I could finish teaching the class. And then once I had surgery and, you know, found out it wasn't cancerous and, you know, spent about 2 months, you know, recovering, I did come to that moment where I realized, wow, I'm not going to be around here for forever. And so I've got this great book idea, you know, am I going to do it or am I not? And so, you know, it really took getting, you know, sick a couple of summers ago for me to get serious, not just about the history of Disneyland as a course, but ultimately writing a book for motivating and inspiring all of us to use Disneyland as that vehicle for making our own dreams come true.
Yeah, and like we were communicating the other day, I just find this format very unique and very appealing. It's a combination Disney history book, sort of an introspection and motivational book. Can you talk a little about how you laid it out? Especially, you have some very unique section titles.
Well, Michael, I would love to tell you, you know, that I am smart enough and wise enough to have seen everything that was going to end up in that book outlined before I ever wrote the first word. But it simply didn't happen that way. I was motivated enough and inspired enough after getting sick that I just made the decision I was going to work on this dream every single day until it was completed. And so I committed to 333 words a day. And there's reasons for that we don't have to get into tonight. But the bottom line is, I got up every single day and I wrote 333 words no matter what. And when it first started, I hated it. The idea that it existed in my head for 20 years wasn't what was coming out on paper. But I didn't go back and correct anything. I didn't go back and edit anything. I didn't go back and change anything. I just kept moving forward. And finally, about halfway through, things just sort of came together. So for example, the very last chapter that I started writing, which is detailing your destiny, which is a middle chapter, oddly enough, was, even though it was the very last one that I started writing, was the very first one that I completed. And it was in that chapter that I came up with the idea of having a souvenir stop, which was, you know, a place for the reader to apply what they've learned to their own life and to their own story. It's also in that chapter where I came up with the idea for the hand stamp story, which was one more Disneyland park story to sort of imprint on our life or on our memory what that entire chapter was all about. And, you know, once I had that first fully complete chapter, I could then go back and look at everything else that I had written and sort of follow that format. And everything really just kind of came together in that process. And so, you know, again, when it comes to your dream, just get started. You don't know where it's going to go. It's one big adventure. It's one big story. You can't possibly have it all figured out before you ever begin. But trust that passion, trust that process, and know that somewhere along the way, things are going to start making sense.
Excellent. That's great. I agree. I mean, I'm a believer to reading your book. And like we were talking, it seems to me this book would be perfect for anyone who is in a transitional part of their life. And maybe they're facing a roadblock in their life and they need to look at what is a goal? What are they going to do? What's their next path? Maybe they're starting a new chapter in their life, like they're graduating from eighth grade in the high school in the college, they're graduating from college, moving into a career. And this helps them set some goals. Maybe they're in a position of leadership in their family, school, workplace, school group, or even a youth group like scouts, band, sports team. So I think this would be not only a wonderful holiday gift, but also for a great graduation gift. Even if you're starting your own business or contemplating a career, I think you'd benefit from Jeff's book. So, Jeff, how can our listeners get a copy of your book, The Wisdom of Walt?
Well, thank you for asking, Michael. First of all, it is available on Amazon. You can get the Kindle ebook on Amazon. You can also get the audiobook on Amazon. You can also get the hard copy on Amazon. You can also order it from my own website, thewisdomofwalt.com. You can also send me an email, jeff@thewisdomofwalt.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Jeff Barnes, or The Wisdom of Walt also has its own fan page. And then lastly, I'm also on Twitter at Dr. Disneyland.
Okay, that's Dr. Disneyland. Yeah. Great. And we will have links to all of that in our show notes. And Jeff, you say that we should all be working on the impossible next. So can you tell us what your impossible next is that you're working on?
Sure. Well, we are working on a second book. It is entitled Beyond the Wisdom of Walt, More Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth. And it's really a response to, you know, what readers have shared with me. You know, the reviews and the reaction to the Wisdom of Walt has really been beyond my wildest imagination and my wildest dreams. And the recognition that there are more stories and more lessons from Walt's life, more stories and more lessons from Disneyland, and even beyond that, I want to tell some of the stories of you know, the Imagineers who, you know, went on and helped create the parks that we love today. So there'll be more Marty Sklar in there, and more, you know, Tony Baxter. I want to do more Disney World stuff in Beyond the Wisdom of Walt. Again, using the parks that we love so much, not just as a place to escape, but really the place to inspire and motivate us to live the best life possible.
And what do you consider one of the greatest lessons you've learned from the life and legacy of Walt Disney?
I the importance of failure. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you know, none of us wants to fail. We want to insulate ourselves as much as possible. We want to get it right. We want to get it perfect. And that simply isn't realistic. And, you know, the idea that Walt was never beaten at anything, I don't think we should be beaten at anything. You know, we need to pick ourselves up. We need to keep moving forward. We need to embrace the idea that our dream needs a hero, and that hero is you, that hero is us, and somebody needs to step up and take the lead, and it requires action. It requires action now. It requires action today.
Okay, well, thank you, Jeff. I think that this was a wonderful way to remember Walt's birthday and his passing, than to talk about what he truly has left us. You know, this was a good reminder that Walt Disney stood for more than making dreams come true on the screen or in theme parks. His true legacy was showing us how we can work to make our own personal dreams come true.
Well, we've come to that time of the show, the time where we have a little fun, we kick back, and we compete in our This Day in Disney History quiz. This time it is for the week of May 20th. And so, of course, we have our returning champion, Craig Williams, in this corner here. Craig?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready.
All right. And we, of course, have a new opponent today here to challenge Craig with his Disney knowledge, and it is the Diz's very own Ryan Teets. Ryan, how are you?
Doing very good. Thanks for having me, Michael.
We're happy to have you. Welcome to Connecting with Walt. This is special because Ryan, although Ryan is a contributor to the Diz, he is our first listener that we have had on Connecting with Walt to challenge Craig. So here you go. There's all this pressure on you, Ryan, because if this goes terribly wrong, we'll never have another listener on again, and they will all be mad at you. And, oh, and you know, and you know how it goes on those Diz boards.
Oh, I know.
So Ryan, why don't you tell our listeners a little about yourself and what you do for the Diz?
Well, like Michael said, I am a contributor. I write some articles. Usually my big one is the monthly rumor roundup, where I recap all the month's rumors. And then I am a moderator on the Diz boards for the Rumors and News board.
Excellent. So how did you come to discover the Diz?
Well, I found the podcast first when I was researching for a Disney trip in about, I think, 2012 is when I about found the Diz. So, yeah.
So, and that was when you were about 10 years old or so.
I was about 8th grade or going into high school about then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Well, yeah, I always enjoy your Rumors Roundup articles there. So they're always very interesting.
Thank you.
So if folks have not checked those out, you want to keep an eye out. When do those articles usually come out?
Usually at the end of every month. So usually about the last week of each month.
Okay, great. We'll keep an eye out for those. But right now, we're going to see how Ryan's knowledge is compared to Craig's about all things Disney. And so, as I mentioned, we're going to look at the week of May 20th and different events that happened in the world of Disney during that week. So for our folks at home who would like to play along, remember, first of all, no Googling, Binging, Yahooing, or anything like that for the answers. First of all, if either of our contestants opt not to hear the multiple choice answers and they get the answer correct, they will receive 3 points. If they choose to hear the multiple choice options and they get it correct, they will get 2 points. If they request to have one of the options removed and they get the answer correctly, they will receive 1 point. However, if one of our contestants does get it wrong, the other contestant does have the opportunity to steal the question, and if they answer it correctly, they will receive 1 point for that answer. So, any questions before we start?
Nope.
Okay, Ryan, since you are our guest, you have the option of either receiving the first question or passing it on to Craig.
I think I'm going to pass this one off to Craig.
All right. Okay. Good, interesting strategy. Let's see how that goes. Okay, Craig, 4 attractions opened at Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom on May 20th, 1973. What were they?
Okay, multiple choice.
All right. Is it A, you might have to jot these down. Is it A, Tom Sawyer Island, Tom Sawyer Rafts, the Plaza Swan Boats, and the Richard F. Irvine Riverboat? Or B, Tom Sawyer Island, Tom Sawyer Rafts, Pirates of the Caribbean, and the Walt Disney Story? C, the Plaza Swan Boats, the Richard F. Irvine Riverboat, Pirates of the Caribbean, and the Walt Disney Story? Or D, Tom Sawyer Island, Tom Sawyer Rafts, Plaza Swan Boats, and the Fort Wilderness Railroad?
Oh, goodness gracious. I'm going to go with, I want to say the one that I was leaning towards was maybe B, but I started getting stumbled up on all the attractions. So B, final answer.
B, Tom Sawyer Island, Tom Sawyer Rafts, Pirates of the Caribbean, and the Walt Disney Story.
Wait, no, not that one. Okay. I think it was A then.
A, Tom Sawyer Island, Tom Sawyer Rafts, Plaza Swan Boats, and the Richard F. Irvine Riverboat.
Yeah, that was it. A.
Okay, final answer?
Final answer.
You are correct. Those all opened at the Magic Kingdom on May 20th, 1973. Of course, Tom Sawyer Island in the middle of Rivers of America is inspired by the famous works of author Mark Twain. At the time, it featured Injun Joe's Cave, the Magnetic Mystery Mine, and Old Fort Sam Clemens. And the Tom Sawyer Rafts in Frontierland take guests to and from Tom Sawyer Island. The opening day festivities include Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher, and they were portrayed by teenagers Stephen Pearsall and Becky Bly. They were chosen during the annual Mark Twain observance in their hometown of Hannibal, Missouri, the boyhood home of Mark Twain. The Plaza Swan Boats take guests on a peaceful trip around the hub off Main Street. The 12 boats are powered by natural gas engines and are designed to run with an electric guidance system. However, this system did not work, and a new steering mechanism was later installed. 2 jets of water below the hull, one in front, one in back, that can swivel 360 degrees and move the boat in any direction. This was a seasonal attraction, and the Plaza Swan Boats will sail away into memory on August 1983. The Richard F. Irvine is the Magic Kingdom's 2nd riverboat. The Admiral Joe Fowler was the first, and it's named for the Dick F. Irvine. He was a set designer with a degree in architecture. He started the Walt Disney Studios in 1942 and worked on the Disneyland team as an early Imagineer. Guests can board the riverboat and sail along the rivers of America from Liberty Square. The Richard F. Irvine will be completely refurbished and renamed the Liberty Bell in 1996. So, Craig, 2 points. Very good.
Ooh.
Anyway, all right. Okay, Ryan, to you now. Here's your chance to get on the board here.
So, okay.
Disneyland guests were treated to this debut on May
21st, 1998. I'm thinking I'm going to go with the multiple choice on this.
Right. It is A. Is it A, the refurbished Matterhorn bobsleds with an ice cavern, glowing crystals, snowstorms, and Yeti? B, the stage door cafe in Frontierland? The new Tomorrowland 1998, or the American Egg House restaurant on Main Street, USA?
Okay. Well, my Disneyland knowledge isn't as good as my Walt Disney World knowledge, so this I'm not entirely sure, but I'm thinking I've never heard of D, so I don't know about that one. I'm going to go with B, the Matterhorn refurbishment.
That was actually A, the refurbished A. Matterhorn?
Yep.
Okay, final answer.
Yep.
Okay, that is incorrect. That actually opened in June. Okay. So, Craig, over to you. Do you want to try this for 1 point?
Yeah. Can you just run through them one more time for me?
Sure. Though? Is it B, the Stage Door Cafe in Frontierland, C, New Tomorrowland 1998, or D, the American Egg House Restaurant on Main Street, USA?
I'll go with Stage Door Cafe.
That is also incorrect. The answer is C. The new Disneyland Tomorrowland is unveiled after being given an extreme refurbishment. Various dedications will take place over the next 2 days. Amongst the special guests are legendary astronauts Buzz Aldrin and Wally Schirra. New additions include rocket rods, a high-speed attraction running on the former People Mover track, Red Rockets Pizza Port, a restaurant that took over the former Mission to Mars attraction, the NASA Space Experience, Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, and the Astro Orbiter replacing the Astro Jets. It has been relocated to the entrance of Tomorrowland and placed on ground level to make the attraction a new focal point from the hub into Tomorrowland and a horrible bottleneck. All right. So it's still 2-0. With Craig, and now with Craig in the lead, and Craig, it is your turn.
Okay.
So on May 22nd, 2009, the Walt Disney Company launched an interactive 40-day train tour to promote the release of this film.
Oh, I'll do multiple choice.
Okay, is it A, Up? B, A Christmas Carol? C, The Princess and the Frog? Or D, G-Force?
Okay. this is a tough one, to say the least. My goodness. I'll take away one answer.
All right, I will take away G-Force.
Yeah, so I had a feeling that wasn't it, but...
So, Up, A Christmas Carol, or The Princess and the Frog?
Well, you said it was May?
It is May 22nd,
2009. Okay, I remember seeing Princess and the Frog in theaters, and I felt like that wasn't in May. I think that was in the winter or late fall. And I could be completely wrong about that. And I feel like Christmas Carol, I know sometimes they release Christmas movies in the summer, so that way once they come out on home release, it's around Christmas. But I'll go with Up. I'll go with A.
All right, final answer?
Yeah.
Okay, that is incorrect.
Huh.
Okay, so Ryan, you can steal this for 1 point. Is it A, A Christmas Carol, or The Princess and the Frog? You have a 50-50 chance here.
Yeah, I think The Princess and the Frog was in 2009, so I am going to go with that, Princess and the Frog.
Okay, it was A Christmas Carol. Believe it or not, Up wow. was released on May 29th, and you are correct. Princess and the Frog was released December 11th. But the answer is B, Disney's Interactive 40 train tour to promote the upcoming movie, Disney's A Christmas Carol, begins in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Union Station. The free traveling experience includes a 3D sneak peek of film footage, carolers, decorations, authentic artifacts on loan from the Charles Dickens Museum of London, and giveaways. Amtrak locomotives and engineers will lead the four-car train tour, plus a private car across the United States, with stops ranging from 1 to 3 days along the way. The tour will finish in New York's Grand Central Terminal over the weekend of October 30th through November 1st. Starring Jim Carrey and directed by Robert Zemeckis, Disney's A Christmas Carol opened in theaters November 6th. So, there you go. Okay. Well, Ryan, it's your turn now. You still have a chance here to get on the board. Craig's only ahead by two. So for May 23rd, this event took place for only the second time in Disneyland's history on May 23rd, 1983.
I'm going to go with the multiple choice.
Okay. Is it A, the park was closed by the fire marshal due to reaching guest capacity? B, the Sleeping Beauty drawbridge, the castle drawbridge, was lowered? C, a guest drowned in the rivers of America whilst attempting to swim from Tom Sawyer Island to New Orleans Square? D, the Main Street Electrical Parade returned for an encore season?
Well, I don't really know. I think I'm going to go with A.
The park was closed by the fire marshal due to reaching guest capacity.
Yes.
You know, that's a good guess. I was there on a day that happened, but that is not the correct answer. So, Craig, want to take a guess? Was it the Sleeping Beauty Castle drawbridge was lowered, or a guest drowned in the rivers of America, or D, the Main Street Electrical Parade returned for an encore season?
My two thoughts are between Main Street Electrical Parade and the drawbridge, but I'm sure I'll find out if I'm wrong here. I'm going to go with the drawbridge just because I thought that Fantasyland reopened in 83 after it was refurbed, but I'm probably wrong. But yeah, that seems like a time where they would lower the drawbridge.
Now, that's the pixie dust is on you. That it is B. Disneyland continues with the grand reopening of the new Fantasyland. The children of the original children who first crossed the drawbridge in 1955 are the first to re-enter 28 years later. In the presence of Mrs. Walt Disney, the drawbridge of Sleeping Beauty Castle is lowered for only the second time in the park's history.
So it had nothing to do with the reasoning that I gave. I just happened to be right.
No, it did. It was part of the celebration of New Fantasyland.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my first sentence there. So anyway, but you know, I have to embellish to give the historical context. So
yeah,
so,
I must
okay.
have missed you saying that one.
Yeah. So okay. So it's 3-0, and Craig, it's to you here for May 24th. Walt Disney received this award from the United States President Johnson on May 24, 1968, in recognition of his distinguished public service and outstanding contributions to the United States and to the world. The award was presented to Mrs. Lillian Disney. So okay. What award?
Multiple is choice.
A, the Medal of Freedom. B, De Molay Legion of Honor. C, the President's Volunteer Service Award. Or C, Congressional Gold Medal.
I do not know. So I'm just going to blindly guess on this one, and I'm going to go with D, the Congressional Gold Medal.
Okay. And a final answer?
Yeah.
You are absolutely correct. In recognition of his distinguished public service and outstanding contributions to the United States and to the world, U.S. President Johnson presents a Congressional Gold Medal to the widow of the late Walt Disney. The Congressional Gold Medal is an award bestowed by the U.S. Congress and is, along with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the United States. Walt Disney had been awarded the Medal of Freedom back in September 1964. He also received the De Molay Legion of Honor in 1931. Just so that you know. Okay. Ryan, good job, Craig. Now you have 5 points. Ryan, you can still do very well here, you know, especially if you're bold. So okay, May 25th. This attraction opened at the Disney MGM studio at Walt Disney World on May 25th, 1990.
May 25th, 1990. I have an idea, but I'm not sure if I want to be bold with it. I'm going to go with the multiple choice.
All right. Is it A, the live action and puppet stage show, Here Come the Muppets? B, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie set adventure? C, One Man's Dream? Or D, Muppet Vision 3D?
I am going to go with D, Muppet Vision 3D.
All right. Actually, that opened in 1991. So I always have to have a Muppet thing in here for Craig. So, so Craig, back to you. Do you want to give your shot at this? This attraction opened at the Disney MGM studio at Walt Disney World on May 25th, 1990. Is it the live action and puppet stage show Here Come the Muppets, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie set adventure, or One Man's Dream?
Well, it clearly has to be either A or B. We all could get rid of One Man's Dream easily, and I don't recall. I mean, I know Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was open for my first trip in 92, but I know that the Here Come the Muppets came and went before I was around to see the parks. I was born, obviously, just not at the parks. So I'm going to go with Here Come the Muppets.
And you are correct. You got a Muppet one. Yes, Here Come the Muppets, a live-action and puppet stage show based on the Muppets, opened at the MGM studio. It will be replaced by Voyage of the Little Mermaid in 1992.
What a shame.
Really, I don't know if I saw this, to be honest.
I've watched it on YouTube. It is just terrible.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have really to look it up. Oh, all right. As bad as Muppets Take Liberty Square?
Let's not go there.
Okay. Well, the last question goes to you, Craig. And so, of course, I have to have a Disney Pixar one in here. The Disney Pixar film Cars stages its world premiere at this well-known speedway on May 26th, 2006. What is the speedway?
You know what? In the sake of fun, I'm going to just guess. No. No. See, the problem is I only know like three speedways, so I know you're probably going to mention all of them in the multiple choice. So, whatever, multiple choice.
Is it A, the Texas Motor Speedway, B, Indianapolis Motor Speedway, C, Lowe's Motor Speedway, or D, the Sonoma Raceway?
Oh, well, okay, the one that I was thinking didn't even get up there, so...
Which one were you thinking?
I was thinking at first... I was thinking Daytona, but then okay. I think I would have remembered if it was in Daytona. Hint. But, see, my gut instinct is now going to Indy, but I feel like that's a weird place to have a premiere instead of out west. You know what? I'll go with Sonoma.
All right, you know, I drive by Sonoma every time I go to the Walt Disney Family Museum, and that would make perfect sense, but that is not correct. So, okay, Ryan, you can get a point here. So is it A, the Texas Motor Speedway, or Indianapolis Motor Speedway, or Lowe's Motor Speedway, where Cars had its world premiere on May 26th?
I was thinking Sonoma like Craig, because it was in California. So that one's out now. And I've been to Lowe's Motor Speedway before. So trying to think of that. I don't think that would be a great place for a premiere, though, either. I'm going to go with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, you know, that would be the obvious one, wouldn't it? But you know what? Even though you thought Lowe's wouldn't be a great place for a premiere, I guess John Lasseter thought it was. Because it is Disney Pixar Cars stages its world premiere at Lowe's Motor Speedway in Charlotte, North Carolina. NASCAR legends Richard Petty and Darryl Waltrip and others from the voice cast of the film are joined by a host of stars from the racing world. Okay, so
that actually makes sense because that's their headquarters for NASCAR, and a lot of the racing ownership groups are based in North Carolina, so that would make sense.
Oh, okay. I was surprised it was North Carolina. I thought it would be a raceway that was on Route 66, so I was desperately looking for one. There's not a lot to choose from. And then when I saw Sonoma was on the list, I thought, okay, that's the one it's going to throw everybody. So anyway, but... But, you know, Ryan, we loved having you on the show, but I'm afraid Craig shut you out 6-0.
I got stuck with all the Disneyland questions that didn't pan so well for me.
I know. It's just funny how it falls sometimes. It's also hard when, you know, all these events happened several decades before you were born.
Yep.
But, yeah, I know. You'd have to memorize the Disneyland show history segments as well as connecting with Walt to really know all these. So, but, you know, we had a great fun with you. And so we definitely want you back next week, because now that you've gotten your feet wet, you know what it's like. You know, I know that you'll do much better next week. So I hope you'll join us.
Oh, for sure. I will.
You know, every time I hear Jeffrey Barnes speak, I always feel motivated to take some kind of action in my life. So,
you and I kind of talked about it when we were thinking about an episode, what to do with this. It just kind of ended up being perfectly worked out and which one we could show, because I was on Amazon and the book ended up coming back into my suggestions for you category on there, and I remember listening to the episode when it was released back 3 years ago, and it still stuck with me to that long, and so that says a lot. That does. So I'm glad that we were able to bring it back and share it now.
Yeah, and the lessons in his book, The Wisdom of Walt, when I re-listened to this episode, it seemed even more important today, especially when, you know, you turn on the news and you hear stories about crying rooms and safe rooms being set up on college campuses, people not being willing to engage in intellectual civil conversation with those who hold differing opinions in order just to seek understanding. And, you know, the free speech for me, but not for thee sort of attitude that seems to have taken hold in some segments of society. You know, we know from Walt's life that he kept dreaming. He listened to everyone. He made up his own mind. He set a plan. And he kept moving forward towards making his dreams a reality. And by doing the same in our lives, that's how we can keep Walt's legacy alive. And I just ordered the sequel to the book that Jeffrey mentioned during our conversation, and I've already been in communication with Jeffrey, and so definitely after I read it, he has agreed to come back on the show to share more wisdom with Walt. So that was also another reason why we chose to bring the, you know, port the show over.
Yeah.
Was sort of to, sort of for our, because we realized that, you know, I know some of our listeners, they were listeners to the old Disneyland show, but we have many, many more listeners who were not. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons we're porting over some of the shows. So hopefully for our listeners who never heard it, you enjoyed it. For our listeners who did hear it, we hope that you heard new things that maybe you might have missed before when you heard it the first time. Because I know I certainly did, and I was the host of that episode. and so that's one of our reasons we bring these shows back over, so that you can catch things that you may have missed, as well as enjoying them once again. And usually there's a motivation for us to do it, because we have something coming up down the road that will build upon an episode that we are rebroadcasting.
Yeah, and so. I even want to take it another step forward and say that if there's any episodes that you remember, especially the people out there who are very loyal listeners to the Disneyland show and Michael's history segments, if there's any of those past ones that you still remember from way back when that you think are, well, they're all worthy of sharing with our audience, obviously, but if there's ever any that you feel like it's something that we should add back onto our feed, even in addition to a current episode that we're putting out, feel free to always tweet at us at our Connecting Walt page on Twitter. So again, that's at Connecting Walt, no with in there. But absolutely, go ahead and reach out to us anytime with that, because we can always add relevant episodes back into our feed, so that way they become more visible for everyone.
Right. And there is another reason, of course, why we are bringing you something from the archives that those of you may remember. A few weeks ago I mentioned Carol, my lovely wife and research assistant, was having surgery. I want to thank everybody who has sent their good wishes, their prayers, their positive thoughts, their pixie dust through every type of social media there is. So Carol did make it through the surgery. I want to give you an update. Her recovery has been rocky. We've had good days and bad days. And it is for that reason that I did not have an opportunity to... We did have a show all ready to go, but just didn't have the opportunity to really finish it up as I would like with my other responsibilities that I'm having this week. So the plan is, of course, to be back on track next week with you.
Yeah.
But so we also appreciate your understanding, and please continue to keep those prayers and positive thoughts and pixie dust coming in, because it's definitely helping.
Absolutely. So. Yes. Okay.
So, Craig, until next time, where can our listeners connect with you on the Diz Unplugged?
Well, of course, you can find me Tuesdays on the Walt Disney World Edition podcast, Thursdays on the Universal Edition podcast, random days of the week on the Diz Daily Fix. Sometimes I'll chime in on the best and worst of Walt Disney World on Wednesdays. And then, as always, on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow me at Teleclaster for all of my whimsical posts or something. Great. But what about you, Michael?
Well, you can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. On Twitter, I'm at mbowling121. That's my personal Twitter account. Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling, but if you want the Disney contact, you want to do the one that has the Connecting with Walt banner. If you do my personal one, you're going to get lots of photos of flowers and things like that, but not a lot of Disney content on that one. Instagram, I'm Michael Bowling the Diz. And of course, Craig has already mentioned our Connecting with Walt page on Twitter. That is a great way to connect with us. I'm enjoying hearing people share how they're doing on the This Week in Disney History quiz. I like people are sharing their scores with us. I enjoy that. And other bits of memories and things that they have of their of the parks. So please reach out to us there at Connecting Walt. And then we also subscribe to a lot of Disney history, sites, so that there's all kinds of interesting things that pop up on that. So if you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes at disunplug.com, and look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. And thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.